Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about design and transport. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications and history. That's CATCH, it's the Catchcast. And in this special edition, we're commemorating the 125th anniversary of an event that transformed world history, right down to this very programme you're listening to now. On January the 23rd, 1901, Isle of Wight engineers working under the direction of Guglielmo Marconi sent a radio signal from the Needles to the Lizard in Cornwall. That's a distance of about 170 miles. It's been cited as the world's first officially recorded wireless communication over the horizon, which directly led to the birth of radio. To commemorate the event, a group of volunteers from the Isle of Wight Radio Society conducted a reenactment of it by transmitting a Morse code message to another group of radio hams who were sighted at Lizard Wireless Station. One of those involved in the event was the chair of the society, Steve Cownley, who we recorded today's programme with last year. Steve subsequently became a familiar voice on Vectis Radio, so sit back and enjoy this replay with Steve on an early Catchcast. In today's edition, have you ever wondered why some homes have those huge big aerials in their back gardens? They look a bit like they're trying to pick up a signal from ET. But these are the homes of the amateur radio fans. What do they do? Who do they talk with? What are they saying? How far away can they pick up signals from? Today we are honoured to be joined by Steve Cownley, Chair of the Isle of Wight Radio Society. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, everybody.
Can I call them radio hams? Is that fair, Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we're one of the only countries, really, that calls them radio amateurs, which is the technical title. But radio hams, no, absolutely fine. The rest of the world refer to them as radio hams. It comes from ham-fisted, back in the day of the wired telegraph operators, when people who weren't official operators started to use it, UCW, as it was. They were ham-fisted, and so that's how you became a radio ham. But it's now... we're all radio hams. It's not an insult in any way.
Jolly. Very good indeed. Now, look, Steve, before we start to answer some of those questions we talked about at the beginning, I wonder whether you can take us back a bit in time to some of radio's historical firsts and tell us about that inquisitive Italian, Mr. Marconi, please.
Yeah. Our facilities manager at the club is Italian, and he's given me how to pronounce his full name, and I'll probably get it wrong, which is Guglielmo Giovanni Maria Marconi. I hope that was right. Sorry, Damiano, if that was wrong. So he was born in Bologna in April 1874. Second son, an Italian aristocratic landowner. He wasn't hard up in any way. And his Irish wife, a lady called Annie Jameson. And to give you an idea, so he didn't attend school as a child. He didn't go on to higher education. But he learnt chemistry, maths and physics and so on from private tutors hired by his parents. And his family also hired tutors in the winter when they'd leave Bologna because, you know, it was a bit chilly, into the warmer climate of Tuscany or Florence. That was really what sort of sparked his interest in radio in general, really.
Last week we were talking about Alexander Graham Bell, who made the first UK phone call in 1878. Was Marconi the first person to ever be broadcasted, or were there other experimentations happening before?
Well, from a very young age, he was interested in science and electricity and so on. And in the 1890s, he actually started working on looking at wireless telegraphy, i.e. the transmission of messages without connecting wires, which is, if any of you have watched cowboy films, you see the guys at the railway stations tapping away on their Morse code key. It was all done through a wire. And so he was actually looking at see if there was a way to do it that didn't require a wire. Now, this wasn't a new idea. Many people had looked at it. Building systems using electrics, electromagnetic conduction, optical, so light, and signalling for probably 50-odd years, but none of it had proved commercially successful, and I think that's the key thing here. He wasn't interested, really, in being the first. He was interested in making moolah. That was what he was really interested in. So that's why he wanted to be successful. But then a relatively new development came from a clever man called Heinrich Hertz, who in 1888 demonstrated that you could actually produce and detect electromagnetic waves. And that was really the start of what we have now. They're referred to as radio waves, and they're measured in hertz, obviously, after him. And then, obviously, you have the variants, kilohertz, megahertz, and so on. So you're listening on 104.6 megahertz, named after him. So that inspired Marconi, really. And from the age of 20, he started to do experiments with building his own equipment. And to give you an idea of his social standing, he used the help of his butler. So the man had a butler called Mignani, and he actually used Hertz's original documentation to actually work on some experiments. And there was another person who was looking at the same sort of stuff called Augusto Righi, who actually published an article on Hertz's work. And at his suggestion, Marconi began using something called a coherer, which sort of does what it says on the tin. It's an early detector based on the findings of the French physicist Edouard Branly, and a British physicist also was involved called Oliver Lodge, and they discovered that it changed resistance when it was exposed to radio waves. A very long and boring way of saying, really, he discovered what radio waves were and how he could find them. And to test it out, he actually built a storm alarm, which went off when it picked up the radio waves that are generated by lightning. And if you've got a radio or satellite TV, when there's lightning around, you get interference. That's the radio waves. And he demonstrated it to his mum. Parental approval is always good. And he made a bell ring on the other side of the house through the wireless radio waves. So he then started to look at making it portable and so on. And ultimately, without him, we wouldn't have ham radio of any sort.
There would be no one listening right now.
There would be no one listening right now because there would be no radio for them to listen to.
Haha, so you have Marconi to blame for this very broadcast. Today we're running a replay of our interview with Steve Cownley, the chair of the Isle of Wight Radio Society, on the 125th anniversary of the first radio signal being sent over the horizon from the Needles right here on the Isle of Wight. So in those very early days then, what exactly was transmitted? It wasn't the human voice, I'm guessing, was it?
No, they couldn't do that. It was Morse code, carrier wave, CW, as we would call it. So literally dots and dashes, very much, as I said earlier, like you see on the cowboy films, dot, 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 dash, 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 dot, 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 SOS. That's exactly what was sent. And the first transatlantic transmission was actually the letter S, so three dots.
Brilliant. When did those first transatlantic things become possible?
So that was sort of 1900-ish. But in the late 1800s, so 1897 or so, the Isle of Wight got involved. And him and his small team of engineers actually took over a hotel at the Needles, at Allen Bay. The Royal Needles Hotel on the clifftop. It was out of season, so the hotel were very happy to have him there. And he came in, lived in, and experimented over the winter months. And probably the next 2.5 years or so, they operated from the grounds as a permanent radio station. So it was certainly the early part, and the range was so much better. It's a high place. Those of you who live on the island, who've been to Allen Bay, you know, it's quite high up, a lot of sea around. Sea is good for radio. The issue was always, though, that there was only going to be a single channel. You weren't able to vary the channel. You had, we're 104.6, and that was it. That's all you had. You would then have to share it with everyone else. And so there was a lot of work that was required to actually help them to get around that. The Isle of Wight is really important to radio, and certainly to Marconi. He really started to become very famous at this point. And he was fortunate because his mum, wouldn't happen now, but because his mum was Irish, he was actually able to get British citizenship.
Aha, clever guy.
Yeah, so that meant he was able to be introduced into society and so on. But it was a difficult time for him. There was subterfuge, spies, the post office were getting involved because obviously they had a monopoly on wireless or wired communications, and here's an Italian upstart coming in and trying to take it. So there was a lot of opposition from the people who historically would have been involved in that sort of stuff.
But crikey. I want to hear more about this. Steve, when did we actually get the first proper radio stations?
Well, Radio first started really at a station called 2MT or 2MATOC, which was of course owner of the first British radio station really to make regular entertainment broadcasts. And that started in February 1922, actually from an ex-army hut near the Marconi lab in Essex. But people were starting to like the idea of radio, and October of 1922 the BBC was formed. And on the 14th of November 1922, Arthur Burrows, who was the director of programmes at the BBC, obviously a new organisation, certainly not the behemoth that they've become, they launched Britain's first national radio broadcasting service, actually from Marconi House in the Strand. The first programme was at 6pm. I don't know why programmes need to start at 6pm. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember TV, first broadcast, 6pm. And it was a news bulletin followed by the weather forecast. And that was a station called 2LO, 2 Lima Oscar. So that's really when radio, as we would understand it these days, really sort of started.
And how about amateur radio then? When did that kick off?
Well, amateur radio really grew in the early part of the year. Once people cottoned on to what Marconi had done, it suddenly became really exciting, and there was a bit of a mania about radio. And in the very early part of the century, there was 6,000 odd people who were using radio. And in 1913, I think it was, the RSGB, which is the Radio Society of Great Britain, was formed, and they really govern what's going on in the world of radio. But ultimately we are licensed by Ofcom, so the same as any broadcast radio station. I'm a full license, so I've taken three Ofcom exams, and I am bound to the rules that they decide. And just as you guys would be the same, if I'm causing interference, they can come round and tell me to turn my stuff off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a pop into a shop, buy stuff and get going. You know, you do need to have some interest. And while there is a lot of plug and play involved, to be legal, you need to have taken your exam, which is something we do at the club. We train people to learn, to get them on their radio journey.
So how would a day be like then, coming down to your society or any amateur society in Britain? I mean, what sort of things happen there? You talk to people immediately, or you get trained?
So our club, obviously, we're as an island, we have a finite pool of people, but it's a, I want to say it's a social club. And our shack, we have radios where people can come up and they can use the radio. Last Friday, for example, one of the guys on the radio had a little chat with some Australia. Really nice. That was very good.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to stop you there.
Yeah.
How on earth can you talk to somebody in Australia? Because what I remember from physics is the signal goes out from where you are on the planet, but it doesn't go around the Earth. So how do you get to someone on the other side of the world?
Yeah, so radio waves are very clever. And the Earth is, as we know, a globe. And around it, you have the atmosphere. And the atmosphere at different times of the day has different densities. And they can actually bounce the radio signal. And so while it is band dependent, so you'll have VHF and UHF, which are a bit more line of sight, maybe 45, 50 miles, something like that, depending on where you are. You will get occasional, we call it skip, where the signal skips off either the troposphere or the ionosphere, depending on what band you're using, and that can travel many, many miles. And this was on a band called 20 metres, which is 14 megahertz, back to our mate Hertz. And the signal, we transmit it goes up into the sky, it bounces off the atmosphere and comes down. It might do that 2-3 times before it actually gets to where it ends up. Yeah, I mean, Australia, that's a good contact off what is ostensibly a bit of wire, because the antenna that the club uses is a bit of wire strung from the side of the cabin into a tree.
So how far would a non-ionosphere bouncing signal go? I mean, are we talking 50 miles or 500 miles?
Yeah, how long is a bit of string, unfortunately? You know, it really depends. The higher band, so VHF and UHF, height is might. The higher you are, the better your signal is going to go. And obviously the atmosphere changes. You'll get lifts where your VHF and UHF signal will bounce and you'll be able to talk to France quite easily, sometimes into Germany and so on a band that isn't traditional. But there are multiple bands that you can use as a radio amateur that go from like 2,000 odd metres for a wave, a single wave, down to 1.2 millimetres. And if you think a microwave is 13 centimetres or thereabouts, something like that. And so if you think about it, if we made a radio and pointed it at a chicken, that sort of thing, we could cook it. You know, we could hold the mic down and we could cook the, because it basically is shooting microwaves. But we also have satellites. So the club, we have a project currently going. We've completed the receiver. There's a geostationary satellite that sits over the Atlantic, which covers most of the world. And you use a satellite dish, you make a helical antenna, and we bounce off the satellites. We go to the satellite, and the satellite repeats the signal. We were having a listen this afternoon. There are people in Greece and Germany and all over the world, and they can bounce off this satellite. But that's obviously many miles. But the different bands have different, you would traditionally say, a different band. 80 metres, for example, is a very good band in the evening. That's an 80-metre single wave, mostly local. So UK, Northern Europe, 40 metres, UK, more into Europe. Sometimes, if the conditions are right, into the east coast of the States. And the bands go, and you have different bands that really cover different, I don't want to say distances, under normal circumstances, you'll have different bands that cover different distances at different times of the day.
We're having a special edition today, rehearing an old interview I did last year with Steve Cownley, now a well-known Vectis radio presenter and also chair of the Isle of Wight Radio Society. It's all to commemorate the 125th anniversary of Marconi's first radio signal from the Needles, and Steve was talking with us about the joys of being a radio ham.
I was going to ask you, Steve, what you talk about when you make these amazingly long distance or more local contacts.
Do you know what? It's a chat. We have contests where the object is to get the contact. You give a signal reading. So you would say 5 and 9, which means your readability 5, which is the highest, and the signal is 9 strength. So it's a really clear signal, probably as clear as, you know, we're coming out to the people that are listening. And that's it. All they're interested in is getting that down, because it's a numbers game. But on the whole, it's a chat. There's a guy in Canada that I talk to fairly often. Over the last year or two, we've got to know each other fairly well. We probably speak maybe once a month. You know, I know him, I know his family, and it's, hi, how you doing? What are you up to? What you done this weekend? Have you done anything? You know, and it's general chit-chat. We obviously have radio in common, so everybody wants to know what radio they've got, how much power they're running, what sort of aerial they've got, because you like to compare. I don't know that it's a jealousy thing, really. It's just good to know what people have got.
You make friends out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are people that you can meet, certainly if you're more local. Back in the old days of that word we don't like to mention, CB radio, you would have an eyeball. And it's the same sort of thing. And in fact, during COVID, the club used to go up to, not Carver Down, Brading Down, so we could be outside and socially distance, and we'd stand around and, you know, have a chat. And an ice cream, obviously, from the ice cream.
Oh, you have to have the ice cream as well.
Yeah.
And what kind of regularity are people on air? I mean, how often do you guys meet at the club?
So the Isle of Wight Radio Society meets on a Friday, 7 o'clock for 2 hours, 3 hours. Depends how long people want to be there, really, at Hayland Farm. So if you want to come along, iowrs.org is the website. And we'll go for a few hours. And people do different things. Some of the guys sit around and have a chat about radio, about whatever. We have the shack, which has got radios in it where people can go and use. We've got test equipment. You can fix stuff. We've got components, oscilloscopes, meters, power generators. So, you know, if you have a radio that's got a problem, you can bring it in. If you don't know how to fix it, somebody there will know. It's, I want to say big boys' toys, but it's not really. The age range goes from, you know, sort of 16 to 80 plus. So it's a very wide spectrum of people. But it's a social club where radio is the one thing that we all have in common.
And you're not limited to just use the radios in the shack, for example.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You can have your own radios. I have mine. Most of the members of the club do. So as I said earlier on, so you have to take exams. Club offers training, which is free. You become a member of the club and you get the training. So there's three levels. You have a foundation, which is the entry-level licence. You have intermediate, as the name implies, it's in the middle. And then you have the full licence. And they all have different levels of technical expertise and so on. But we could train you. And once you're licensed, there are no real restrictions over what you do. You have, it's recently changed, Ofcom changed it recently, you've got a bit more power for the entry level, but you have access to the whole range of bands. You can spend as much or as little as you want to spend, really. But yeah, home, in the car, on a boat, all of those, you can do everything.
Now, you used a very important word there, spend. Mm. Could you join this hobby pastime for under £100? You'd spend £200 or £300?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's what you want to do and how much you want to spend. So you can buy a basic 2.70 centimetre handset. So that's a VHF and a UHF. You can buy one of those off well-known Chinese sites. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention them. So Alibaba, Temu, that sort of place. If you have an account with those, 25, 30 quid will buy you an entry-level radio that you can use as a foundation license holder. And that gives you access to 2 metres and 70 centimetres. On the island, we have a 70 centimetre repeater, which I'm the owner of, which rebroadcasts the signal. They, in Southampton and Portsmouth, they have 70 centimetre repeaters, they have 2 metre repeaters. So, yeah, 30 quid will get you into amateur radio. If you want to go into HF, so to talk all over the world, you're probably looking, in fairness, probably maybe £400 or £500. If you go secondhand, yeah, considerably cheaper than that. And as I said, you can make an aerial out of a bit of wire. Who hasn't got a bit of wire hanging around?
But you do need to get approval first from Ofcom.
Absolutely. You need to pass the exam. So, as I said, the club will help you. We'll train you to pass, get through the exam. And once you've passed the exam, first one, yeah, you're away. You can then use everything. And certainly at the club, you can use the power. So as a foundation license holder, you're limited to 25 watts. That's a lot. When I was a foundation license holder, I could only use 10, but they've changed it recently. But I could talk to Canada on 10 watts. Wow. It was from the Olawite. It was fine.
Wow.
So you have 25 watts. But if a full member, a full license holder is with you, you could use their capabilities if you use their call sign. So what we would do is we would use the club's call sign, which is G3 Sky. If you use the club call sign, as long as the full license holder is there, so me or one of the other full license holders, that person who's only allowed to run 25 watts can run a kilowatt, so 1,000 watts if they want to.
I could talk for a lot longer with you, Steve, but
yeah,
we're coming to the end. Could you give us maybe a website that is available nationally as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So iowrs.org is the club's website. rsgb.org is the Royal Society or the Radio Society of Great Britain. But if you do a search for amateur radio, there's loads, or ham radio, there's loads of places that you can have a look.
So next time you go past a house with one of those great big aerials outside, remember it's not a secret spy network or someone trying to contact ET. It's the lovely chatty radio amateurs talking to people hundreds of miles away. Thanks to Steve Cowney of the Isle of Wight Radio Society for opening the door on this fascinating life of amateur radio enthusiast. Well, that was Steve Cowley speaking last year about his love of radio. And then, of course, he came on to join the Vectis Radio team of presenters. And we brought you that on the 125th anniversary of Marconi's first radio signal broadcast from the Needles down to Cornwall. And congratulations to the Isle of Wight Radio Society, who conducted that wonderful commemoration of the event at the end of last month when they reenacted the sending of that auspicious message, without which maybe you wouldn't even be listening to this very show today. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art, transport, communications history, and we're going to be looking at the rise and demise of the bus map. So please do join us then.